Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 141, Hypnotic Dream Work and Emotional Freedom Technique, March 7, 2008. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
She had this dream where she was standing in front of a desk, and on the desk there was a broken statue of a dog. And it was all in, like, it being smashed, not just broken. It was all in tiny little pieces, and she was trying to fit them back together so that she could glue them back together in the dream. And the task, you know, she would just get too, you know, it's like this horrendously huge puzzle that she was trying to do, and she'd just get two pieces together, like, to try and fit them together, and then they'd fall apart, and she'd lose them in the pile again, and she became overwhelmed with it, and in the dream, just kind of slumped over the desk with her head in her hands and began to cry.
That was the voice of my guest, Nancy Hunter, describing the dream of a patient. Nancy Hunter is a psychotherapist in private practice in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. Nancy's been working in the field of personal change since 1989, and she is a clinical member of the Ontario Society of Psychotherapists, a master practitioner of classic and advanced Ericksonian hypnosis, certified with the National Guild of Hypnotherapists, certified in advanced emotional freedom techniques, a master practitioner of neuro-linguistic programming, and a registered Canadian art therapist. Nancy has experience working with a wide variety of clients' life issues, from the simple to the more complex. She's worked with people having concerns such as smoking cessation, weight management, habit changes, phobias, anxieties, depression, childhood abuse, or trauma, sexual, physical, and psychological, and disordered eating. She has worked with children as young as 4 and adults as old as 75 and every group in between. Nancy graduated in 1989 from a 2-year graduate-level course at the Toronto Art Therapy Institute. Since then, she's worked at hospitals, schools, and other community institutions. Now, here's the interview. Nancy Hunter, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Yes, thank you, David. I'm so very glad, pleased to be here.
Yeah, and I'm so glad to have you. You know, every now and then I get an email from a listener who I realize would make a good guest for Shrink Wrap Radio. And I think you wrote me not long ago that you've been a listener for some time. And in response to a conversation I've been having with my friend Jerry Trumbull on Shrink Wrap Radio Live about hypnagogic and hypnopompic imagery. And I recall you saying that you had those sorts of experiences from a very early age. Is that right?
Yes. I don't know how early, but since I was much younger than I am now, certainly.
Yeah. Now, I know, you know, as a result of the email that you sent me, I know that you've been doing therapeutic work for about 12 years. Is that right, about 12 years?
Actually, it's longer than that. Since 1989, I graduated.
Oh, okay. So, however many years that is, my math isn't that great.
Yeah, I can't figure it out. It's close to, it's like 18 or something, 17 or 18.
All right. And you're up in Toronto. I should probably mention that as well.
Yes, I am.
And so for those years, you've worked in a variety of modalities, including art therapy, NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, EFT, emotional freedom technique, and hypnotic dream work, or hypnosis generally, and also you mentioned dream work using hypnosis, which I was particularly interested in. So I'd like to touch in on each of these during our conversation, but let's start off by going back to 1989 or somewhere thereabouts And let me ask you, what first drew you to this therapeutic work, to wanting to do this sort of work with people?
Well, I guess it was my own process, you know. I'd gone through a lot of stuff myself and needed a lot of therapy. I've been through a lot of therapy. And at some point during the course of that, I said, I want to do this.
And I think that's often how people come into it. And it's certainly one of the best ways to learn is if you've been in therapy yourself, particularly with, you know, with one or more good therapists, then there's nothing like the modeling and the experiencing from the inside out to learn it.
Yes, that's right. Actually, I think it's essential for anyone who wants to be a therapist or psychotherapist to have their own therapy and have that experience, whether they think they need it or not.
Yes.
I mean, I definitely knew I needed it, but
uh-huh.
Yeah.
Right. Now, I didn't notice, I noticed letters attached to various certificates after your name, but I didn't see any graduate degrees. And so let me just ask you about that and whether or not that creates any licensing problems for you up in Canada.
Well, actually, that's a big question because we're just starting here in Ontario to regulate psychotherapy as a profession. It hasn't been regulated until now.
Interesting.
Pretty much anybody could put out a shingles mm-hmm. calling themselves a psychotherapist, whether they had training or not. So I'm not sure exactly how that's going to go, but I have a Bachelor of Arts from a college in Hamburg, Germany. I was living in Germany for quite some time. And that was enough to get me into the Toronto Art Therapy Institute here in Toronto, which is a graduate-level diploma program. They weren't and still aren't, as far as I know, directly connected with a university. So it didn't give you a university degree, but it was a graduate-level program. And so that was my sort of inroad to being a psychotherapist was the art therapy training.
So do you think you'll be able to get grandfathered in or grandmothered in if some
quite
kind of
possibly.
Licensing?
I mean, that's what we're going for. I'm mm-hmm. a member of the Ontario Society of Psychotherapists, and we as an association or a society have been involved in the process of the bill being passed and now you know being involved in the process of putting it into practice, and we are hoping that that happens because the Ontario Society of Psychotherapists is one of the one of the main associations in Toronto that has or in Ontario that has tried to regulate the psychotherapy profession even before it was formally regulated.
Yes, it's a lot more regulated down here, as you're probably aware.
Yes,
And that was partly what stimulated my question, because I think here, if one were to call oneself a psychotherapist without the requisite graduate degrees and licensing, then they
right.
could be up for some kind of legal action. And at the same time, you know, and I've got mixed feelings about all of that. I do think it's important for people to get to be well trained and to have a good sense of ethical boundaries and so on. And it seems like you have, in fact, sought out a considerable amount of training. Plus, as I mentioned earlier, I think having been in psychotherapy, I see that as a kind of training as well.
I do as well. Yes, definitely. It's a big part of it, I think. Yeah.
Yes. So you started out in art therapy, so and you went through, I think you said it was a two-year program. It sounds like that would have been reasonably rigorous.
What it was, yes.
Yeah.
There was papers to write, you know, sort of all along the way throughout the program, as well as a thesis to write at the end. And you had practicums throughout, as well as classroom things, and you had to undergo your own therapy during the course as well.
Yes. And what drew you to art therapy in particular?
Well, because I had already been an artist, so it seemed like sort of the natural thing to do, I guess, or, you know, sort of an extension of what I'd already been doing, you know, because I'd been involved in my own therapy and I was an artist.
Yes, and I think often that's a path. I know of other artists who've made that transition and branched out into art therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And what have the challenges and the rewards been of your involvement in art therapy?
Well, I mean, it was certainly challenging in the beginning. I remember the, you know, starting in the program there, and they started you out with a practicum right off the bat, and I had no idea what I was doing, and suddenly I was in a room with a young boy who was a quadriplegic, and I'd never been involved with anybody with that kind of disability before. And
oh my goodness! How are you supposed to
barely
do
talk
art? How are you supposed to do art with someone who's quadriplegic?
He had some. I had to do a lot for him in terms of preparation and that kind of thing. But he had some movement of his hands, and he loved it. He just so enjoyed that. He would use mostly, you know, like the finger paints, and he could move his hands to some degree, but, you know, it was very uncontrolled. And actually, I remember one of the thing that he really loved doing was painting himself. He would get the paint all over his hands and then, you know, put it all over his face and would refuse to let me wash it off before he left the room, and would go through the hall then with his face all green or red or multicolored.
Wow, that certainly must have communicated to you that he was taking some joy in this process.
Oh, he really was. I could definitely see that he was really enjoying it, but it was so frustrating because I had such a hard time understanding him.
Yes, yes. And so I would think one of the challenges for somebody with, say, after you newly get your degree in art therapy, is how do you find your clients? Because it's hard to imagine people out there saying to themselves, I think I need some art therapy.
Well, you know, after I got into private practice, I found that pretty hard. I mean, when you're in an institution where they're doing art therapy, your clients are there, you know.
Yes, exactly.
Whether it's a school or whatever it is. But in private practice, I did find that a challenge because a lot of people say, well, I'm not an artist and I can't do this. And, of course, you tell them until you're blue in the face that you don't have to be an artist, and it has nothing to do with making a good picture. You don't have to know how to draw. People still have that kind of reluctance.
Yes.
So that was certainly a challenge. But I found actually after I added hypnosis to the mix that I got more clients because people seem to be fascinated with hypnosis as I am.
Yes.
And was. And,
yes.
That brings them in more. So yeah. I actually end up doing more of that kind of thing now in private practice than art therapy. But I still do get people wanting to use the art, and I still use it.
Okay, so that's moved into more of the supplementary position in your
yes.
work. Yeah.
Yes, actually, yes.
Yeah. And just, you know, before we leave that, though, you say a person doesn't have to be an artist to
absolutely
get the...
Absolutely not, no.
So say some more about that. Of course, I sort of know something about that, but maybe all of our listeners don't. So talk a little bit about what the... You know, what's the rationale for doing it, and why is it that a person wouldn't have to be an artist to get value from it?
Because it's really just about letting yourself draw or paint or use whatever the materials you want to use in whatever way comes naturally to you. And it's not about making a pretty picture. It's about drawing about or around sort of the things that... are issues in your life, and it's a method of communication and expression, and it really does help to get to those underlying issues and talk about them and resolve them.
So do you see it more as a way of communicating what the issues are, or do you see it as being healing in and of itself?
Both.
Both. Uh-huh.
Yes. because it definitely helps to get to the issues, because sometimes, you know, you draw things and then recognize later that, wow, that looks like such and such, and oh my God, that reminds me of, and it just sort of leads to the real issue that are sort of maybe under the thing that you were thinking about. But it also helps the healing. It just, in expressing it, first of all, it's in the body, as everything is, and it comes out through that, and that process in and of itself is healing. And plus, it's things that are coming out of your unconscious mind through the body, and you can work with them on the page and change them in your picture, and that helps to begin a process of change within you.
Mm-hmm.
As well.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, you can express something that's painful and difficult, but
sometimes much more easily with art materials than you can with by talking.
Yes.
Sometimes you can't talk about it, and some of the experiences you might have had might have been even pre-verbal, and they will still come out in the art.
And then you're suggesting that by transforming it on paper, it, as you begin to maybe express it in a more healed way, or in trying to, maybe you encourage people, well, you know, now paint a picture of what it would look like if you felt better, or if this problem were resolved.
Sometimes I suggest that, and sometimes mm-hmm. it just happens naturally too, because it brings in the unconscious mind, just brings in all of its resources.
Yes, I think it's a lot like dreaming, you know, that it taps into that same unconscious level, and that over a period of time, ideally, and maybe you've seen this, I mean, I haven't really, I've done this sort of thing in the context of teaching and not in the context of long-term work with, you know, with a therapy client, but my understanding is that as the process, as the healing unfolds, that would be reflected in the artistic productions that the person would make, just as seems to happen with dreams, that as a therapy process goes on, at first the dreams are very troubling, but as the person gets better, the dreams seem to signal that as well.
Yes, definitely. Yes.
And so you see
and that's why it mm-hmm. seemed to me sort of a natural extension to work with images, not always on the paper, but also just in the mind.
Yeah, so how that sort of segues us into your work in hypnosis. So tell us, how did you become involved with that?
Well, I'd done a lot of reading about it before I was formally trained in it. A court course, the main person I was reading about was Milton Erickson, who was this amazing hypnotherapist.
Right.
And just transformed the way hypnosis was seen and used, and was so creative with it, just amazing. And a lot of reading also about just guided imagery and that kind of thing. And I was doing guided imagery with some of my clients before I was formally trained. Actually, I remember one client who had been using art, actually, and was dealing with several things in her life, and said at one point, you know, isn't there something like that you can, because she'd been working in computers and was learning it and so on. And she said, isn't there something like a disc that you can, you know, like I have this disc I put in my computer and it just cleans everything up.
Yeah.
and you know, normally in psychotherapy, you that's sort of a warning signal and you got to go, oh, no, you know, that's a process. And you know, I was just about to start to say that. And then because of the reading and the thinking that I'd been doing around this, I said, well, because this is her own image, you know.
Yes.
And I'd been reading also a lot about, and I'm not sure if I can remember the woman's name now. She did a lot of work with imagery in healing from cancer and that kind of thing.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. There have been a number of people who've written about that.
Yes, yeah. And I've been reading about that. And, of course, the most powerful images for that kind of thing are the images that come from the person. When they arise spontaneously for
yes.
that person, that it's something positive and significant in their lives, and they use that as a metaphor for how the body can do the healing. Well, this woman came up with this, and I thought, well, it's her image, so who am I to say that, no, you can't do that, you know? So I said, well, let's explore that. And if you can think of how you would have a disc and you would have something plugged into your body somewhere, and where a disc like that could go in. And so in the next session, we did that. And before we actually got started, she said, you know, but the disc for my computer, if it comes up with something that it can't handle, it can't handle it, you know, if it's not programmed for it. And I said, yes, of course, but your disc is not so limited because it's your disc, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It can handle anything that needs handling.
So and you so took her through some kind of imaginal process?
Yes, yeah. Just relax and sit and imagine, you know, that you have this plugged into you and you're inserting the disc, and then I just let her do it. And as I watched, I saw a transformation come over her. It was amazing, really, because I saw the expression on her face change, her posture shifted, and it was quite wonderful, really. And afterwards, she said, you know, I imagined the disc going in, and then all these words just kind of circled around me. Peace and love and confidence and all these different words, they were just kind of circling around me and passing through me, and it was such a transformation. It was amazing.
Yes, interesting.
And she got what she needed in that one session.
wow, yeah, that's a good story. Now, in the email that you sent me, you mentioned that you have a way of working with dreams in hypnosis. Why don't you tell us about that?
That sort of came out of having heard about the Senoi Indian tribe that I believe you mentioned in one of your conversations
yes.
on your live show.
Right.
And in that, they... the whole society is focused around dreams, and they're encouraged, from the time that they're children, the first thing they do in the morning is get up and tell each other their dreams. And if they have scary dreams, they're encouraged next time they have a dream like that to, instead of running from the thing that's scaring them, which is what we normally tend to do in dreams, to turn and face that thing. And say it's a tiger, well, you want to become one with the tiger in some way. So either you let the tiger eat you, or you eat the tiger, or conquer the tiger, or you engage in it, with it in some way, befriend it, perhaps, so that you get from that figure, or whatever it is that's frightening you, what it's come to give you. And I thought that was just so neat.
Yeah, I know. We all did when we read that article. It just seemed to that these people had, you know, without ever having had any exposure to Carl Jung, for example, had worked out their own way for taking symbols seriously and working with them, integrating them into their lives.
Yes, yes. And I thought, you know, they're so fortunate because it starts from the time when they're children, and it becomes so part of the fabric of their lives that when they do have dreams like that, their natural tendency is then to turn around and face the thing. And I think, you know, because we don't have that kind of thing built into our lives, it's very difficult to for us to then, in a dream, turn around and face the thing that's frightening us. We still tend to follow our natural instinct. And I thought, well, you know, if you could become lucid in your dream, then you could do it, perhaps. But that's a difficult thing to achieve as well. And most people can't or don't, at least.
Yeah, I know. I've worked at it. And, you know, some people that I've talked to become very lucid very easily, like other human traits, you know, probably some kind of bell-shaped curve. And there are some people out there who are on the extreme end of being dream athletes who can easily become lucid. Unfortunately, I'm not one of them. And maybe,
I'm not either, unfortunately.
Maybe among the Sonoy, maybe if you're sort of taught that from an early age, then maybe it is a skill that you can learn and that would stick with you through life, you know, if you were born into a culture that had that idea and really supported it. But most of us aren't born into that.
Right. And I think in that culture, even if you weren't, even if you didn't become lucid in your dreams, the principle of turning to face the thing that's frightening you would become more ingrained, and you would be more likely to do that.
Yeah. And the other good lucid idea I want to put out there for listeners while we're talking about this is if you're having a falling dream, which I think most of us have had at one time or another, to try to become lucid enough to turn it into a flying dream.
Yes, yes. And see, that's the basic principle, really, of the way I work with dreams in hypnosis. Because, see, from thinking about the dreams, the way the Sonoy dreamt and that kind of thing, and thinking, you know, I wish we could do that.
Right.
You know, and then when I learned hypnosis, I thought, well, with hypnosis, you can do anything. You know, you could go back into a dream if you remembered a dream. You could go back into the dream during hypnosis and guide a person through that dream and change it and dream it differently.
Yes.
And resolve it in some way. Like your example with if someone was falling, encourage them to find a way to fly. Or, you know, hit the ground. I mean, it's not like in the movies where you die if you hit the ground. You don't.
Yeah, right. maybe you could teach them to bounce.
Yes, exactly.
I never thought of that before.
So that was my thinking with it. And I started doing it with clients. And just, it's an amazing thing, really, because when the person goes back into the dream in hypnosis, it begins to unravel. It begins to, it just continues sort of in a natural way that the images change and shift in the same way that they would in a dream.
Mm-hmm.
It just, it goes on in a very natural way. And if I'm there to guide them through the process and to look to doing things in different ways, then they can do that.
Well, can you make this more concrete for us by maybe telling us about a case that you worked with, one or more cases where that happened?
Yes. I had a client who had lost a dog, at least not lost it, it had died, and it had become very old. She'd had it for a long time, and it'd been sick for a long time and died, and there was a whole grieving process involved with that. And I'm not sure exactly how long it was, close to a year perhaps, or half a year at least at this point, and it had sort of, the grief had faded to a great degree. And she had this dream where she was standing in front of a desk, and on the desk there was a broken statue of a dog. And it was all in, like, it being smashed, not just broken. It was all in tiny little pieces, and she was trying to fit them back together to so that she could glue them back together in the dream. And the task, she would just get too, it's like this horrendously huge puzzle that she was trying to do, and she'd just get two pieces together, like to try and fit them together, and then they'd fall apart, and she'd lose them in the pile again, and she became overwhelmed with it, and in the dream, just kind of slumped over the desk with her head in her hands and began to cry. And so she told me this dream, and there was more to it too. There was parts of it before that. See, in the dream, I usually tend to focus in on the point of where there's a higher degree of emotion, or that seems to be the sort of the focus of the dream.
Sure, that makes sense.
Or importance.
Yes.
So I focused in on this part and took her back into the dream, and as she was sitting there in front of it, I said, so, it's impossible to fix this, so you're not even going to try now. What would you rather do? And she said, well, I just want to take my arm and just like sweep it all off the desk. And I said, well, go ahead and do that then. And she did. And I said, how is that? And she said, it's like I'm becoming this huge monster now. It's like I'm growing and I've got big claws and I'm this huge monster. And that was not pleasant for her. And I brought her then back again to, okay, so now you're back sitting in front of the desk again with the, it's all on the desk in the way it was in the dream. And this time you're not going to sweep it off the desk, and you're not going to try and fix it. What would you rather do now? And she just sat with it for a moment, and she said, oh, it's reassembled itself, and it's become this very pretty statue of a dog in a certain pose that she sort of described. And that was just wonderful for her. And we had also been talking before the dream about, because she'd been trying to clean up her place too. She's gotten into quite a huge degree of disorganization. And we were talking about not forcing yourself to do it, but just because forcing yourself to do it usually gets you overwhelmed, and then nothing gets done.
So as so often happens with dreams, that dream seemed to be expressing at least two different conflicts
different
at the same
levels.
Time. Yeah.
Yes, yes. And we talked about it afterwards, and I said, so you see what happened when you didn't try to force yourself in the dream to do something with it? And she said, oh, yes, it just reassembled itself. It just did itself. So, like, as soon as she took the pressure off, it reassembled itself. And that's kind of, it works with the principle of the chaos in her life, but also with the grief over the dog. Because with the dog, she said, I was helpless to do anything for the dog, too. It was sick for a long time. It was in pain for a while. She said, I couldn't even comfort him.
Did this session seem to help to resolve this continuing grief that she had been going through?
Yes, yes, because I think also, and we did talk about this afterwards, too, it seemed like it gave her a way of keeping the memories and keeping the memories whole without that need to constantly think about how she could have helped the dog better.
That's interesting, keeping the memories whole. That
for 20 years. You know?
Mm-hmm. And that's really speaks to me, that the way that the statue got brought back together again.
Yeah. Yeah,
into a
and
whole
that, see,
form.
That just it just happened spontaneously within the dream.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it kind of continues. The dream just the images come. I could give you another example.
Yes.
As well, of a woman who was going through a lot of changes in her life. She had a very dysfunctional family, and she'd had a lot of bad relationships in the past. And she was with a man who she said now was really good and kind and generous and very different from her previous attempts at relationships. And but she was still having a hard time making the commitment to the relationship. And but they were even talking about wanting to have children and that kind of thing. And so she had this dream where she was in a swimming pool with this man, and they were just beginning to kiss, and then there was all these fish swimming around them and kind of nipping at her and dragging her attention away from him. And so I took her back into that dream, and as soon as she got into that part of it, it changed immediately. It just like the fish were circling around her, but then it became a tornado, and she was in this tornado, which lifted her up off the ground, and she said, "Oh my God, it's all the things from my life were in the tornado around me and just like whirling around," and she's up in the air. And so I encouraged her to bring it down to the ground. I needed to get her back on the ground again. And she was doing that and said, and it's funny because you said bounce it, you know, you could teach them to bounce. Well, she was bouncing at first when she first came down. Whoa, it bounced up again and back down, and it keep bringing it down. And each time she would bounce a little less, and then she was finally on the ground, which was a good thing. you know, just that concept of grounding oneself, it seemed to be necessary in that dream. And she said, but now there's all this stuff around her, and it's just like it's all a huge, it's skewn over the whole landscape. And I said, what do you want to do with it? And she said, I just want to be rid of it. I want to be rid of it all. And I said, is there nothing of value there that you want to save? No, I want to be rid of it all. I'd really just like to bury it. And I said, well, okay, do that. See, I often, if someone says I want to do something, I'll let them go ahead and do it. And if it turns out not to be the way they thought it might, like with the woman in the other dream, she just wanted to sweep it off the desk. And she did that, and she felt like she was turning into a monster by having done that. And that wasn't a good thing for her. So, but in the dream, it's not irrevocable. You just go back to the point where you began again and do it differently.
In the hypnotic dream.
In the hypnotic dream, yes.
Yes.
But also it allowed her to express her anger about it without having the consequences of it in the dream. So in this dream I said, well, so go ahead and do that and let's see what happens. And I said, there'll be a ready-made hole there somewhere where you can put it in. And so she did that. She put it all and began to cover it over with earth. And it, she said, it keeps coming up. It keeps, you know, coming back up again. And I said, well, look around. There'll be help for you there somewhere. And there were a whole bunch of garbage men. This is what came up for her.
Uh-huh.
There were garbage men who then helped her to get it all into the hole and bury it. And she said, it's still coming up again. And I said, well, there'll be something else to help you if you still want to do this. And I said, are you sure there's nothing there that is of value for you that you want to keep? And she was absolutely certain of that. So she looked around, and there were fairies with steamrollers. And they came and, you know, rolled over it and made it absolutely smooth, and it wasn't coming up again. And then the fairies kind of lifted her up.
Now, this was her spontaneous image, the fairies,
yes,
with steamrollers?
Yes.
That's good. That's I seem to recall that the Sonoy, that one of the things that they taught their children was to call upon allies or assistance if they needed them.
Yes, and that's exactly what I do with them. That's what I said with her. I said, look around, there'll be some help for you there.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what there was. First, there were the garbage men, and then there were the fairies. And the fairies, first of all, with steamrollers, which helped, you know, to bury the stuff. And then they picked her up and carried her. And she just enjoyed that so much. It was, as she said, it was afterwards so wonderful to have help, not to be alone with it. And to be carried afterwards, to just let herself go and be carried in a very soft and gentle way. And she said afterwards, like in the session following that, the following week, that she felt that something really had shifted within her.
I think one of the things that we would want to underscore here in these two accounts is that where a lot of dream workers from other perspectives might get involved in interpreting the dream and interpreting the symbols, you don't do that, right?
No, I don't do that. I let the symbols speak for themselves. Because we're just working directly within the dream. And I don't really talk about the symbols before or afterwards, mm-hmm. unless a person really wants to, but mm-hmm. usually they're satisfied because they've come to some resolution within the dream.
Mm-hmm. So instead of analyzing the symbols, you take them back into the dream through hypnosis and then encourage a transformative process to unfold.
Yes, yes. And encourage the person to bring in and look for whatever help might be there, whether it's an inner healer or whatever it is. And like with this woman, I didn't specify it any further than to say that she could look around and there would be someone or something there to help her.
Mm-hmm.
And her own psyche came up with it.
Yes. Now, before we run out of time here, and we may actually, we have two other approaches that I wanted to touch base on. You also use NLP and EFT, so I wanted to make sure that we talk about each of those. So how did you come to bring NLP into your work, and you know, where and how might you use that?
Well, the NLP, I had also read about a long time ago when the books first came out by Bandler.
Bandler and Grinder.
Bandler and Grinder. But didn't, and thought it sounded fascinating, but didn't know where or how to learn it. But so much later, it was actually through learning hypnosis, I found the Ericksonian hypnosis course. It was offered through NLP Canada, which is here in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, they also teach NLP. So after I'd done the hypnosis course with them, I decided to do the NLP course as well and went on to do the master course and continued to attend the courses for a long time afterwards and was even helping to assist with the trainings after a while. So the NLP, and it's always difficult to explain sort of what it is because it's so many things.
Yes, I think I've found that a challenge in interviewing. I've talked to a couple of people in this series about NLP, and it never gets all that concrete, I think, for somebody who's not studied it to know exactly what we're talking about. So,
Well, the thing is, it's hard to say exactly what it is because you could describe it in so many different ways because it is so many different things and it's being used in so many different ways. It started out definitely as a therapeutic modality, but it's being used in business and, marketing and sales, but also in teaching and education, learning, as well as in therapy.
Well, let's talk about how you use it in your work.
Okay, well, so one of the main things that as a tool, like as a concrete tool that we use are called personal edits. And see, what I learned was the new code NLP as opposed to the classic code, which arose after Bandler and Grinder kind of split over a number of different things. I won't get into that. But so the new code is actually goes back to the roots of NLP as Grinder saw them, and what came out of that are what's called personal edits, and they allow you to edit parts of your personal history that have sort of emotional impact and an impact on your life that you would rather they didn't. In other words, negative emotions, or what we might call negative emotions, to edit that so that you have more choice about how to feel about things.
Okay, this sounds in some ways like it might be somewhat similar to the process that you just described with the dream work.
Well, I suppose, although it's done much more sort of in your, well, it uses trance too, but in your waking life. like some of the techniques that they use as personal edits are you're up and moving around. There's one that's called Walk with Grace and Power, where you walk back and forth while you're thinking through your difficulty. And usually that will begin bringing you back into the feelings, you know, the sadness, anger, grief, whatever it is. While the coach is coaching you to change your posture and your walk and so on, and you keep going through this process, and afterwards you go back and think about the original thing, and it's changed. It's different. I sort of see EFT as being, as working at least. It's got a whole different theoretical underpinning to it, but it works in much the same way as one of the NLP personal edits might, in that it will just remove the negative feelings or give you choice about how to feel about a particular thing. And usually once you have real choice and it's not just kind of overcoming you, you don't go back to the negative emotions, and it helps you to change your perspective on things.
Yeah, it also it seems like we're going to get into alphabet soup here, but
yes, I know.
Because also, I'm thinking of EMDR, eye movement desensitization reprocessing, and that seems to me to be very similar to EFT.
Yes, and I'm not trained in EMDR, but I have experienced it once. There was a man at one of the courses I took that had been trained in it, and he took me through the process of it, and so that I could just experience it for myself. And the effect is very similar to the EFT in that it removes the feelings. Only I, for myself and my clients, I think that the EFT is more useful because they can learn it, and they do learn it just through me taking them through it, because it's a very simple tapping procedure. And they can use it in between sessions to help the process along.
Well, let's just give a little bit more explanation about EFT. It stands for Emotional Freedom Technique, and it involves tapping on points. Are they considered to be acupuncture points?
Yes, it does actually come from acupuncture points, yes.
Okay, so you're tapping various acupuncture points on your, mostly on your face and
On your face and on your body and on your hands or in your arms. There's points now, like new points on the legs or like up the ankle.
Okay, now I'm a little bit skeptical about this one, I have to tell you.
Okay.
And sometimes I've been skeptical about some of the claims for NLP at times too.
Yeah.
So what's the theoretical understanding of this. First of all, where did it come from? Who invented it? And okay, you know, how's it supposed
came,
to work?
It came, first of all, from a man called Roger Callahan, who, and this is the story of how he began to discover it, actually what was called TFT, which stood for Thought Field Therapy. He had a client called Mary who had a phobia of water, which, you know, she couldn't sort of get very near any water without uncomfortable feelings, and certainly larger bodies are of water. And the story goes that he was working, she'd been working with therapists and hadn't made any headway, been working with Dr. Callahan for 2 years, and they'd made some headway in understanding things, but really hadn't changed the phobia at all. And in this one session, Dr. Callahan at the time had been learning acupuncture, been learning to use acupuncture.
Oh, okay.
So he, you know, knew the points and so on, or at least becoming familiarized with the points. And in this session, Mary was talking about some of her problems. She had nightmares and headaches and so on, which all seemed to be associated with the phobia of water. And she was talking about some of her difficulties with the fear, and happened to mention that her stomach was upset. And because Dr. Callahan knew or was working with acupuncture, he asked her to tap on her cheek, on like just below the on the bone of the cheek, just below the eye, and you know, just because he thought like that's the it's associated with the meridian for the stomach, and he thought it might help her upset stomach. So she did that while she continued to talk about her difficulties. And after a while of doing this, she jumps up and says, "I don't have the phobia anymore. I'm not afraid of water anymore." And he was incredulous. And there was either a fountain, or I've heard two versions of the story. One was a fountain, one's a swimming pool in the basement of the building. But at any rate, she runs down to the pool and splashes water in her face from it and is fine with it. And so Dr. Callahan is astounded and could see the only difference, the only thing that was different in that session than in others was that she had been tapping on this one spot. And so he did more experimentation and so on, and out of that came to the discovery statement, which holds for EFT as well, that all negative emotions are caused by an energy imbalance in the body. And he developed this whole system called TFT, or thought field therapy, which involved muscle testing to help determine which spots needed to be tapped and in which order for a specific difficulty. And it was a fairly long and involved procedure. And he began teaching this to other people, and Gary Craig was one of them. Gary Craig learned this process and at some point said, you know, this, it's such a long and involved process. People can't do it for themselves and so on. Could we not simplify this by just simply working out a tapping sequence that would include all the major points, and then you could just use it for everything? Some of those points might not be necessary, but it certainly doesn't hurt to tap on them. And the whole sequence, you know, even if you're taking your time with it, would take, you know, 2 minutes or, you know, five if you're really going slow. So that's what he did, was just develop that tapping sequence that uses all of the points, and so you're kind of doing an overhaul, and some of those points might not be necessary. And in fact, there are shortcuts that are useful for most things, but also since then there's been other points that have been added to it and so on. But it's a very simple procedure that you can use, and we often do have those kinds of one-minute miracles where, you know, you tap on and the thing is just gone.
Well, have you personally in your work had clients who've had either 1 minute, or I'll even grant you 50-minute miracles?
Yes. For people who don't have like a lot of trauma and that kind of, and long history of dysfunction in their family and trauma and that kind of thing in their background. So that
are there such people out there?
Well, there are some. Not very many.
Right.
Certainly not in my work, anyway. But there are some. I have, weight loss is a big thing for many women, and I have used it for women and with weight loss, and for people who don't seem to have a lot of background problems like that, it works very quickly. For other people, and see weight loss or weight management, it can be a huge thing. And it's, you think it's a simple thing and it's really not, because there's so many different things that impinge on eating behaviors. There's so many different emotional reasons for
right.
Why we eat the way we do, and when we do and how much we do and so on. It's very often not a simple thing, but I have experienced it being a simple thing with some women who have had, four sessions with me, and we've addressed a few issues in their life. I remember one woman, she had some interpersonal difficulties with her sister, and she would just get so upset. And we tapped on that, and she's fine with her sister now. Like, she has no problem with her at all. And we only did, one session of tapping on that, and probably several different rounds, but it was only in one session and only part of one session. And she doesn't have any problems with her sister anymore. And we tap on individual food cravings and specific situations where she's likely to have food cravings, and she doesn't have that problem anymore. And then she'd come in the next session and say, well, it's starting to come up again, and so we just do some more tapping on it. It's usually a different aspect of the same thing, and then she's good with it. Like I said, though, for people who have, multiple difficulties, it's not that easy. But we still make progress. It helps things along. What we do is narrow things down as far as we can to a specific issue and a specific incident of that issue, where like a concrete example of that issue, and we'll tap on that, and that one thing will be resolved. It's gone.
Okay,
and
well,
I've actually seen people in my office, and they've talked about like these huge problems that have been bothering them for a long, long time. We sit and we tap on it, it'll be like a 50-minute hour, and we'll talk about different issue, like aspects of it, and tap on those, and then this, and then the other thing. And at the end of that, I'll ask them to go back to the original thing and think about it, imagine it as intensely as you can, like actually try and get the feelings back, and they can't.
Try to get the anxiety feelings.
The anxiety
back.
Or the yeah. grief or the anger, whatever it is, yeah.
Yes. Boy, there's so much more that we could discuss about this, but I'm afraid we've run out of time. I will, after the session, I'll be sure to mention your website so that people can contact you additional information. And I want to thank you, Nancy Hunter, for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio and for being a listener.
Well, thank you, David. I think your show is great, and I'm really pleased to be on it myself now.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Nancy Hunter. Since we've run long, I'll keep my commentary here quite brief. First of all, you'll find Nancy's website at www.innovativepsychotherapy.com. I'll put a link in the show notes as well. On her site, you'll find additional information and resources there about hypnosis, hypnotherapy, art therapy, NLP, and EFT. You'll also find two hypnotic induction recordings that you can download there for a small fee. One focuses on stress reduction and the other on going within to work on any issue of your choosing. I've listened to both and am pleased to recommend them to you. I should also mention that Nancy wanted to do an EFT session with me on the show, but I declined for three reasons. One, I couldn't think of an appropriate issue in my life right now. Things are going pretty well. Two, I was concerned it might not make for entertaining listening for you to hear me tapping on various parts of my body. And three, I did have a chance to experience the technique myself in a workshop I attended last year.
You want to learn about the inside and what makes us tick? You could find all the answers you need real quick. Get on the couch with Dr. Dave. Leave your worries behind. It'll all be fine. It's Shrink Wrap Radio. It's all in your mind. For insight into personal growth and the inner life, here's Shrink Wrap Radio with Dr. Dave.
I'm afraid we're running long here today, so I'm going to keep this part short. And I'm going to skip the listener email. My good friend Jerry Trumbull and I are planning to do another Shrink Wrap Radio Live on Sunday, March 16th at 9 a.m. Pacific. You can listen in live, you can post comments in the chat area, or call in on the phone line. The phone number will be there on the site. Just go to www.blogtalkradio.com/shrinkwrapradio. And the focus of our discussion will be communication. And we'll be referring to a wonderful article in the March National Geographic titled Inside Animal Minds. And you can find the full text of this article on the National Geographic website with a little hunting. The URL is too long for me to give it here. We'll also be discussing communication in autism, drawing upon an article in the March issue of Wired magazine. Now, I'm not sure if that article is online or not, but for your homework, go to YouTube and do a search on Amanda Baggs. And Amanda, and that's B-A-G-G-S, you'll be amazed. And then if there's time, we'll talk a bit about the HBO series In Treatment, where communication also plays a very big role. Now remember, the sponsors for this show are Podshow and GoDaddy. Thanks to all of you who've bought domain names at GoDaddy and use the discount codes on our Shrink Wrap Radio website. Those discounted purchases also help to support this show. So that's going to wrap it up for today. Remember, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave voicemails for me on Skype, where my name is ShrinkPod. You can also, if you have a microphone on your computer, you can use MyChingo, and there is a MyChingo button on the website. And in the U.S., you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks again to my guest, Nancy Hunter. My next guest will be Dr. Jonathan Haidt, speaking about his wonderful book, The Happiness Hypothesis. This is Dr. Dave saying it's all in your mind.